Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Ka'Chava's All-in-One Whole Body Shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Try their newest flavors, like the limited edition Chocolate Mint. With Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code SHAKE for 15% off. Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Ka'Chava's All-in-One Nutrition Shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your Ka'Chava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code SHAKE for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code SHAKE.
From depression and anxiety to Alzheimer's and brain fog, more and more research is pointing to innovative therapies that can reset the way our brains function. One of the most exciting, ultrasound stimulation. Welcome back to another episode of the Biohacker Bondi podcast, where we talk all things health, wellness, longevity, and of course, biohacking. I'm your host, Jenny Jones, and I've spent years exploring cutting-edge ways to optimize the body and brain so you can take your health into your own hands. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Taylor Kun, a neuropsychologist at UCLA and researcher at the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior. His work is focused on the transcranial focused ultrasound, a groundbreaking non-invasive technology being studied for conditions like depression, PTSD, dementia, and more. In this episode, we cover how ultrasound can tune brain circuits linked to mood and cognition, why this approach may offer fewer side effects than traditional treatments, the potential of combining ultrasound with therapies like exosomes and AI, and where the research is heading in the future of brain health and longevity. If you've ever wondered whether we can reprogram the brain or if non-invasive technology could replace medication in the years ahead, this is the episode you don't want to miss. Okay, so welcome to another episode of the Biohacker Bondi podcast. I am so excited for this one because we're going to get all into brain health, psychology, mental health, ultrasound, all of it. And we are here with Dr. Taylor. And you have quite an extensive background. You have your PhD in psychology, your fellowship at Harvard and Boston University, postdoctoral fellowship at UCLA. You have such an extensive background, and you are board certified in neuropsychology. And you are also the founder of this amazing technology called SAMMI. We have a lot to get into. We'll try and keep it short and the questions as, you know, as short as possible. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast, taking the time out of your day. If you can give a little intro and what inspired you to get into psychology.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very grateful to be here, and it's certainly an honor. And thank you for that introduction. Both of my parents were college professors. Grew up reading a ton and asking a lot of questions. And I was kind of probably a little bit of a pretentious philosophical teenager, and I wanted to know how things are. And I figured there are two ways to answer that question. One was kind of from the universe in with physics, and one was from the inside out with neuroscience. And so I started off in, you know, University of Florida, go Gators, as a psychology major. And then I kind of, you know, I have this kind of Taoist surfing through life tendency. And so I just kind of surfed through the courses that I loved. It was drawn to neuroscience, and I was always really interested in brain-machine interfaces. I will consider it a personal and professional failure if I don't download a book into my brain before I die. But I didn't want to be an engineer. I'm from a small town in Florida next to NASA, so everybody I grew up with is either in the Air Force / Space Force or is an engineer, and I knew that wasn't my route. And I wanted to work with humans, not rodents or primates, so I went into neuropsychology. which is kind of allowed me to become a mind mechanic. Right? I got to collect data on how a person's mind and brain works by understanding their cognition, their psychiatric functioning, and how their body moves as a way to understand the health of their brain. And that allowed me to kind of move towards both research. You know, I carry a research lab at UCLA, and towards this brain-machine interface where we use ultrasound to, I call it a cognitive or affective, meaning emotional, neural prosthetic. So instead of connecting to the brain to move a robotic limb, we're connecting to the brain to improve memory, improve learning, improve attention, reduce anxiety, reduce depression, that kind of thing.
That is so cool. I'm so fascinated by the brain. I think we've been focusing so much on the physical body and not thinking how important the brain is to restructure our body with hormones, sleep, all these amazing things come from the brain. And we have to think about brain health first, almost. You know, it's like that is what is controlling so many parts of your health. And so there's so much, I think also a lot of people are struggling. So I'm always about improving brain health, optimizing brain health, but also there's a lot of people that are struggling with brain health and neurological disease and pain, anxiety, depression. So, you know, in your practice, what do you see are the most common with patients? Like, is depression kind of the top, anxiety? What are you seeing more and more of with your patients overall?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it depends a little bit if we mean mental health issues or if we mean neurologic issues. And I see both kinds of patients in my practice. I think from a mental health perspective, especially in the last 5 years, both as the younger generation is getting a little bit older and more independent, and as we watch the baby boomers continue to transition further into old age, we're seeing a lot of depression, a lot of kind of existential anxiety, and isolation, in part related to technology, in part related to the pandemic, and in part related to a host of other factors. So there's this, including, you know, Western culture. So I think there's a lot of anxiety and depression that I think we really kind of are looking at the wrong way and thinking about solving in the wrong way in this country. We're trying to solve, you know, the label of depression without an understanding that yours and mine look very different at the symptom level and then trying to address us as a unique individual. Neurologically, in part because I work with adults rather than kids, I see a lot of older adults who are concerned about dementia. And so the prevalence of dementia is getting worse and worse over time as we have such a big group of baby boomers hitting that age. And movement disorders. There are more and more people with Parkinson's, with essential tremor.
Yeah.
And just the functional impact is so profound, especially if you think about something like Parkinson's, which can basically attack anywhere across the adult lifespan, mid-20s to your 70s or 80s. And I think it's really kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I've, been listening to podcasts. Also, I know like pesticides could be a huge issue for people. They're discovering, certain areas of where you are located, the water can affect some of these neurological diseases. I think we're getting closer and closer to that, but I want to hear, so I guess we'll just start with Alzheimer's, dementia. What is your practice? What do you look at? If someone comes to you and says, hey, I have Alzheimer's, dementia, what are the tests you start looking at? What are the things you're doing in your practice? Because you are in it, and I want to know what the future is for Alzheimer's and dementia.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I may, I'll kind of give you an orientation to where we are right now, but then also where I think we should be, and we could be there tomorrow with the right focus. So right now, someone comes into my office, we spend the entire day doing pen and paper and computer assessment of their cognition, their thinking skills. I ask how well you pay attention, but then I'll read you a series of numbers, let's say 1, 2, and you say 1, 2 back. And then that series of numbers gets longer and longer. Nobody has an attention span of 30 digits, right? So somewhere in there, we find that patient's attention span, and I can compare that to the attention span, the number of digits of someone their age and education, and say, oh, you're in the 8th percentile, or you're in the 93rd percentile. So by doing that with attention, how processing speed, how well you learn and how well you remember information, higher level things like problem solving and multitasking, I end up with this entire categorization of real objective data of how someone's brain works. So with the Alzheimer's patient, for example, I would see objective data that showed that they can't form new memories. Old memories that they have, they can still pull out of the filing cabinet of memory and go, oh yeah, you know, when I was 23, this happened, I finished college and then I got married, moved over to Denver, or whatever it may be, but they can't form new memories. So I have this nice objective data set that tells me exactly how their brain is working and confirms the diagnosis. But then the biggest question is, what do we do about it? And with dementia, it's often really underwhelming, right? Like, what does the research say are some of the best things you can do? Low impact cardio 3 or 4 times a week. That's kind of underwhelming. Mediterranean diet. Improve sleep. Now, the science behind that is fascinating. For example, the reasons.
Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Kachava's all-in-one whole body shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Try their newest flavors, like the limited edition chocolate mint. With Kachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Kachava, KACHAVA.com, and use code SHAKE for 15% off.
Sleep is so important. Is that during, depending on which wearable device you use, either deep sleep or slow wave sleep, which are the same thing, there's something called the glymphatic system, which the cells in your brain creates more space between them, and the system washes out all the debris, the detritus, the plaque, kind of like in your heart, that builds up and clears it out. That deep sleep / slow wave sleep breaks down, and we get less and less and less of it as we age, which means that as we're aging, our brain's ability to clear the gunk out gets worse. So the reason that getting better sleep is helpful is really cool, but telling people to walk, eat better, and sleep better is pretty underwhelming when it's either them or their family member who has dementia. So what else could be on the table? Where there's some really excellent practices now that I'm really grateful to be working with, who do things like very fine level SNP-based genetic analyses. They're doing them for people who already have cognitive concerns or maybe already have dementia, but they're also doing it for younger adults. I'm in my late 30s, for example. And you can get an idea of not just kind of these broad, I have APOE4, which means I'm at increased likelihood of developing dementia. But what are, you know, if I look at 600,000 SNPs in my genome, what other things, not just that specific one, but what other things am I at risk for? And now what can I do now 30 or 40 years before hopefully I don't develop dementia to start making a preventative change? Because unfortunately right now, by the time we get to the point of dementia, it's often too late. But that leads to things like ultrasound, regenerative medicine, like stem cells and exosomes, and then attempts to try to reverse the progressive deterioration of dementia. And I think we're starting to get there from a scientific perspective.
If you're spending money on your skincare routine, serums, moisturizers, facials, but if you're still washing your face with tap water, you might be undoing it all. Tap water can be filled with chlorine, heavy metals, and impurities that strip your skin's natural microbiome, leading to breakouts, dryness, and dullness. But what if I told you I had the answer? It's called Filter Baby, and it's a total game changer. You just screw it on to your bathroom faucet, super easy, and thousands of people, including me, are already seeing the difference in their skin. I used to get random breakouts for no reason, but since using Filter Baby, I have clear, calm, and healthy skin. If you deal with acne, sensitive skin, or just want your glow back, Filter Baby is a no-brainer. Click the link in the show notes or head to the shop tab on my website, and don't forget to use the code BIOHACKERBONDY for a special discount. Your skin will thank you. Did you know your body can actually recharge with light? Red light therapy has been shown to support recovery, reduce inflammation, and boost mitochondrial energy, the foundation of how your cells function. FlexBeam is a portable, wearable red light therapy device designed to target specific areas of your body, whether it's sore muscles, stiff joints, or simply supporting overall energy and recovery. It's like having a professional recovery tool at home, but without the hassle. I've been using it as part of my daily wellness routine, and the difference in recovery and focus has been incredible. If you've been curious about red light therapy and how it can support your longevity, FlexBeam is a game changer. If you've been curious about red light therapy and how it can support your longevity, definitely check out FlexBeam. You'll find the link in the show notes below. For DNA, we all know the APOE4. I know that probably 98% of the world doesn't. But what are other DNA markers that you would look at for maybe increasing your likelihood of developing Alzheimer's?
So the best paper that I've read recently came up with this umbrella understanding of what Alzheimer's probably is in a way that captures all of the different things that we know happen, right? One of the big pharma companies spent $20 billion trying to solve Alzheimer's disease with a pill that was going specifically after a single kind of one of the plaques that builds up right off of the synuclein. And then they failed and they closed their neurology department. And they had put people, I'm sure, smarter than me trying to solve the problem, but they should have been able to predict that because it's not a single breakdown disease, right? There's eight different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be trying to solve all of those eight different things. One of them is the sleep problem and not clearing things out. Another thing is there's something called neurovascular coupling. When I push this accelerator in my car, more gas goes into the engine and it goes faster. When I'm trying to use part of my brain, it needs to, those brain cells need to pull more blood and oxygen to get the fuel to go faster. That's so the coupling between neurons and vasculature, and that breaks down. And Alzheimer's disease, which leads to oxidative stress and deterioration of neurons, right? So there's a whole bunch of things breaking down. And one of the kind of this really nice overarching framework described it as potentially in, all of those different things can be driven by an autoimmune issue. And so there are inflammatory markers that you can look at. There are a lot of what we've noticed in histology inside those plaques and tangles, the gunk built up, are some viruses mm-hmm. that most of us carry around, like herpes or toxoplasmosis. Herpes or toxoplasmosis or cytomegalovirus, and they're viruses. Like this, we're all like, I think 11% of my genome is virus. I currently have the common cold in me, but my immune system is sufficient to keep that viral load down so I'm not symptomatic, right? But it's still fighting that off all the time. We know that people living with HIV, part of the reason that they are increased likelihood of developing dementia is their brain is in a chronic state of inflammation because they're constantly fighting the viral load in their brain. So doing things to reduce inflammation, change oxidative stress, improve cardiovascular health, like there's all of these holistic kind of all body parts. As you said, we're paying attention to the body, but not the relationship between every system in the brain. And that's what I like, as opposed to looking at like APOE4, which is a very specific. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. But yeah, all of this, and it's just everyone wants that one answer for something, that one supplement, that one gene, that variant, you know, that one biohack or device. And it's like, first of all, the basics. First of all, get rid of inflammation. You know, autoimmune is on the rise. And I definitely think it's from leaky gut, from all the pesticides in our soil, in our food, our water, the chemicals in our water, the air. Like, we're just surrounded by toxins we've never been surrounded by before, and it's disrupting our gut, causing leaky gut, causing inflammation in the body and the brain. And as much as we want to think of stem cells, exosomes, you know, all these things, amazing procedures, we also need to still do the basics and eat organic, stay away from all those things. So it's a little boring. A lot of people just want that like one pill, that one device, but also the basics, sleep is so important. I think people don't realize as you get older too, I believe the melatonin decreases, your pineal gland, all those things. So, you know, as you're saying, all the basics and be preventative is the best idea. But what if someone has Alzheimer's? Are you doing any other tests, neurological tests, testing the neurotransmitters? I know you also work with Dr. Sheldon Jordan, who I interviewed, and he mentioned a test where now we can see specific neurotransmitters and how they're functioning. Are you doing this test? And let's get into a little more ultrasound, exosomes.
Absolutely. Well, first, I want to completely agree with you. I think we live in a culture, unfortunately, where people would rather turn to a pill or a scalpel and get surgery than do lifestyle changes. And I think the problem is pills come with side effects. Surgery requires rehab. And if we make daily lifestyle changes, you end up building a healthier, more robust life and not just increasing longevity, but increasing health span, right? I don't want to be 90 and feel 90, but if I was 90 or feel 38, sign me up.
Yeah.
So absolutely. So that's that type of test that Dr. Jordan was describing is a certain type of MRI called MRS, magnetic resonance spectroscopy. So it lets you use an MRI to look at these kind of spikes on a graph that tell you about different neurotransmitter levels. We absolutely look at that. We use advanced MRI imaging clinically all the time. So not just looking at the structure of different brain volume regions, but also looking at how much blood flow is going to each brain region. You can look at neurovascular coupling that we talked about with MRI. We can look at the structural connectivity. So how...
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you think about the brain like an apple, the skin and the seeds or the computer chips doing the stuff, and all of that white apple meat, those are the cables connecting them. So we can look at the health of the cables, so that's structural connectivity, and we can look at how well they're functioning together. So right now you're listening to me, that's the audio, you're looking at me, that's the video, so the audio and video chip are working really well. But a minute ago, somehow the audio cut out, so they stopped functioning well together, even though they were still connecting structurally, right? So we're able to look at all of that with MRI, which I'm a huge proponent of. I'm associate director of one of our brain research MRI centers at UCLA. I do a lot of brain research, ran the Human Connectome Project at UCLA, which is at the time the biggest human brain MRI project at the National Institute of Health at Farnborough. So the research foundation for using these tools is immense. Sadly, they've been slow to come into clinical practice, and we're trying to kind of pull them into that space. And thankfully, as a serial entrepreneur, I have been contributing to and have seen a bunch of other companies and investors pulling these advanced MRI tests into this space, which is great because we want to be able to see and track within a person how these different attempted treatments are changing or not the brain. You need to know how things are going for the patient.
So I never thought I'd include whey protein in my diet until I found Kona Nutrition. Now I get it, why it's everyone's go-to for building muscle, because it actually works. I had the pleasure of interviewing the founder and we talked all about whey versus beef isolate and why whey is more effective when it comes to building muscle. But Kona Nutrition is more than just protein powder. Their whole mission is health first. Their whey comes from cows that have 2 acres to roam. It's grass-fed, RBST-free, no soy, no GMOs, no antibiotics. It's minimally processed with the lowest heat possible, which makes it way easier on the digestive system. And it's third-party tested. Seriously, it's the cleanest whey protein I've ever tried. I add it to my frothed milk, my cookies, my psyllium husk breakfast, and it's the perfect way to start your day with protein to help balance blood glucose and stay full longer. You can find the link in the show notes for a special discount, or you can use my code BiohackerBlondie at checkout.
Is this MRI a special MRI, right? Because if I go get an MRI in most hospitals or clinics, it's not going to test for these things.
Right. So that scanner can do it. And that head coil they put on that's a little claustrophobic is what you need to collect these different scans. But there are different licenses, software licenses on the scanner, which allow the scanner to take the right picture to collect that data. And then, and this is a problem in clinical work and in research, every different research center and every different clinical office that's even attempting to do this writes their own software. There are very few FDA-approved softwares to do this. There's I think, three at least in structural scans. So every time you go get a brain scan, they'd give you a picture that tells you, you know, my hippocampus, which is where I make new memories, what breaks down in Alzheimer's disease, its volume is X. And there are several of these FDA-approved softwares that will segment and go, okay, here's just the hippocampus. Taylor's hippocampus is this volume, and this is the percentile relative to my peers.
But in structure. Yeah.
Just structure. But in terms of all of these different advanced ones we've talked about, that's just not there yet. I hope that it will be soon. One of my companies is trying to contribute to that. Numerous other companies are as well. But it just hasn't gotten there yet.
So there's only a few clinics that have this scan, basically.
Correct.
And there's also, do you guys test? I know there's a certain test where kind of if you have deterioration of the brain, it can leak into the blood. It's like called it's a specific blood biomarker. Have you heard of this? Enfilament. Or what are those other tests that people should look for?
So we've been talking a couple of times about the different plaques and tangles, the gunk that can build up. Those are things like tau, apolipoprotein, and alpha-synuclein. It used to be that you needed to do a lumbar puncture or draw spinal fluid out of your spine to test for those. We can now test for those in the blood. There are several companies that have blood-based markers of those. And so that's one thing that you could look at. And those are not specific to Alzheimer's disease. They can happen in many, if not all, of the different dementias. So you can look and see how much those are in your body doing a blood test now, which makes them much safer, much more convenient, and much easier to track over time. There's better ways to look at things like neural inflammation now. And as in one of the topics is ultrasound. Ultrasound is really cool for three reasons. One, it can, as my lab and my company are driving towards, be itself the treatment. But it can also allow you to targeted deliver things into the brain, or they call them needleless biopsies, get things out of the brain. So for example, if you have a brain tumor, instead of drilling a hole in the skull and doing a biopsy into that tumor in the brain to get cells out, you can do ultrasound where that tumor is near what they call the blood-brain barrier, right? What keeps the most of the body and the brain separate. It'll open up the blood-brain barrier a little bit and some of those tumor cells will come out. And then you draw blood just like you normally would and you do a biopsy of the tumor that way. So using ultrasound to help understand what's going on in the brain was absolutely part of our future.
If you're not testing over 100 biomarkers annually, you're likely missing one of the biggest factors affecting your health deficiencies. And here's the thing, when just one vitamin or mineral is off, it can throw your entire system out of balance. We're talking brain fog, fatigue, sluggish metabolism, poor sleep, immune dysfunction, and worse, it can even contribute to chronic disease down the line. That's where Function Health comes in. They make it easy to finally get the full picture. Function tests over 100 key biomarkers, from hormones to inflammation, nutrients, liver, kidney, thyroid, and more. Then you retest in 6 months to track your progress and optimize from there. And the best part, they partnered with thousands of labs across the US, including Quest Diagnostics, so you can likely find a blood draw location just a few blocks from you. It's seamless, it's science-backed, and honestly, it's the best pricing you'll find for this kind of comprehensive testing. Let's be real, your doctor isn't ordering these panels for your yearly checkup, but they should be. So stop guessing and start testing. Click the link in the show notes or head to my website under the shop tab to sign up for Function Health and access your over 100 biomarkers today. This will truly be one of the best investments you can make in your health.
Yeah, I think, you know, I just did an ultrasound, you know, looking at all my organs, my heart, my thyroid in Berlin at this clinic called Years. But a lot of people just think of ultrasound as just looking at your body parts. Right. And so you're saying there's a lot more we could do with ultrasound. So can you explain this a little bit? Because you have this device now that is not out yet, but it's super cool. I'm so excited. So if you can explain this device and explain ultrasound, and then I want to go back to Alzheimer's of what you would do for these things.
Yes, ma'am, of course. So I think the most common kind of diagnostic or imaging ultrasound that people are familiar with is looking at a fetus or a baby in utero, right, inside a woman's womb. And so if you think about that like a flashlight, it's got a really big beam. And so it's kind of almost like sonar. You get this really big beam, it bounces off things and comes back, and we decode that bounce back image or the bounce back ultrasound beam into an image. Instead of having a really big searchlight, you can narrow it down into a really specific spotlight. People who get kidney stones, they already do this. It's called lithotripsy. You use a very focused ultrasound to shake up and break up the kidney stones. So instead of passing one big gnarly stone, you get to pass a bunch of very, very small broken up ones. In the brain, ultrasound has a huge range, right? At high intensity, which is very much not what I do and not what we're going to talk about in a second, but in this country, we have diagnostic ultrasound for the brain, which has been they've been using it since at least the 50s, where you can, for example, look at blood vessels
doctors,
in the
offices.
Brain. You can see if there's a clot or if there are emboli, kind of things bouncing around the blood vessels of the brain. So we've been using diagnostic ultrasound for a very long time. Again, take that, make it very, very small, focus searchlight, and at a high intensity, neurosurgeons can use it to ablate or cause a small lesion in the brain, which they sometimes want to do for things like, Parkinson's disease, where causing a small lesion might help, or seizures, where causing a small lesion might help. That's done through being such a high intensity that it can burn the tissue or cause tissue damage in other ways like cavitation. Now go from high intensity, there's this really big mid intensity, but down to low intensity, and you can actually modulate the brain activity without causing any damage. So instead of heating it up or causing the cells to burst, you're jostling them and changing the cell membrane in a way that makes it more or less likely that they are active. So you can basically stimulate to make a brain region more active, turn the volume up, which we might want to do for the hippocampus and the insular cortex for Alzheimer's, like improve activity to make memory better. Or you can make it less likely that a brain region will be active, quiet it down or disrupt it, which we know, we published on this, that you would want to do, for example, with the fear center, the amygdala, in people with anxiety. You turn that volume down and reduce anxiety. So you have this ability to non-invasively modulate or turn up or down specific brain regions.
You guys know I'm always looking for science-backed ways to improve gut health and immunity, and this one blew my mind. I started using Kepos, the first human milk, yes, human milk equivalent superfood. It's based on human milk oligosaccharides, which are these incredible molecules that help feed your good gut bacteria, strengthen immunity, and even support brain health. Honestly, I wish I had this years ago. It's been such a game changer for my digestion and overall energy. If you want to try this for yourself and see how it works in your own life, just head to the link in the show notes and use my special discount code BiohackerBlondie for 15% off your order. Simple, easy, and such a game changer.
And the reason this is so important is because before ultrasound, if we think about the Apple again, most of the non-invasive technologies we had, all of them, like TMS, for example, could only get to about 70% of the skin of the apple. The other 30% and all of the white matter, all the meat and seeds, they couldn't touch. Ultrasound can get to all of that. Before ultrasound, the only way to get to the rest of the part of the brain was with brain surgery, where a surgeon implanted an electrode directly into the brain. So now we can do all of that on both of them.
Can you explain also the difference? I think people have tried TMS, transcranial magnetic, what is it? Transcranial magnetic stimulation. So can you explain the difference and what people have been using that for versus the ultrasound?
Absolutely. So TMS is great. I don't in any way want to undervalue it. It's FDA approved for numerous things, including depression, OCD, migraine, and I believe nicotine cessation. And the age range that has been approved for continue to expand. I believe it's recently been expanded into adolescents for some of those conditions. So the idea there is you're placing a magnet somewhere over the skull. That magnet is going to use a magnet stimulation, it's a transcranial through the skull, magnetic stimulation, to induce electrical activity in the brain tissue underneath it. So for example, for depression, they aim for the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex. They can either try to stimulate or disrupt, just like we were talking about before, turn the volume up or down on a specific brain region. And try to change the activity of that network, leading to changes in symptoms, right? So for the DLPSC, they're trying to change depression symptoms. There are some people who go to, this is called the posterior parietal cortex. It's not a strong component in Alzheimer's disease, but it's strongly connected to the hippocampus, which is the seat of Alzheimer's disease. But as I mentioned, TMS can't get to the hippocampus. So they're trying to kind of engage the network by targeting a region that's connected to it. So TMS can be great. A lot of people get remission from anxiety, depression, OCD, smoking cessation. It has a really good efficacy. Its durability is often several years. It has some downsides. Again, the functional ones that it can't get to all of the brain. It can be kind of painful, which makes kind of going through sessions a little tricky. It also makes doing research on it hard because to do a placebo, you've got to make the placebo hurt also. So again, the things I'm excited about with ultrasound, and again, I don't want to diminish TMS. It has a really meaningful clinical role in more diseases than it's currently FDA approved for. I'm grateful that researchers and clinicians are moving it in that direction. And also, ultrasound can get to all of the brain. You can't feel it, so it doesn't hurt. Which makes studying it very easy, because placebo is easy because you can't feel it. And instead of inducing an electrical charge, you are actually changing the way the neuron is functioning, which I think allows you to shift the brain in a different and potentially more durable way.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing. And I want to hear how this new device coming out, how it works, because it's a headset. You put it on. How does it know which area to target? Very specific. And yeah, I want to hear more about this amazing device and when it comes out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the reason I mentioned that high intensity ultrasound is currently diagnostic ultrasound. So like looking at the brain imaging wise, that's got FDA clearance. And this high intensity lesion in the brain has FDA clearance. No one has yet gotten FDA clearance for modulating in the brain with ultrasound the way we modulate it with TMS. So our company is trying to be the first to achieve that. And it's I think, a very sleek, comfortable headset that has the ability to place the transducer in three different regions depending on what brain region we want to target. Currently, we use what's called neuronavigation. So you get a structural brain MRI and you load it into a computer, and it's got cameras. And those cameras kind of watch where the device is. And you can, as you move the device around on the screen, the angle of the device relative to your own individual brain MRI changes, so you can confirm what you're targeting. But one of the things we're most excited about, we just closed our more recent funding round, and our lead investor, Reid Hoffman, who's really big into AI companies and AI funding, part of what brought him on and what he's talked about publicly about he likes about our company is we create our own software to use AI to make our targeting safer and thereby making it more effective. And so what I mean by that is, I'm from Florida. I love the ocean. I scuba dive. It means I've got a saltwater fish tank downstairs. And glass changes the angle of light by 30 to 40 degrees. So if you look at a coral in my fish tank and try to put your hand in the tank, you're going to miss it, because the glass it makes it look like it's somewhere different, because the glass literally changes the angle of the light. Your skull does that to the ultrasound. It changes the angle of the beam. And so that changes your target, right? If you just assume that it's like a bullet goes straight in, you'd be wrong. So we created this software that takes your MRI and then uses AI to predict or to estimate your skull thickness at every single point. And then we know what our ultrasound beam looks like. So we can actually model how the skull warps the beam to predict exactly where it will go, so that the clinician, the surgeon, whomever can click and go, I want the energy to go right there. And then our software, again, using AI, tells you, okay, if you want the energy right there, put the transducer here. Put the ultrasound device right here. And it takes into account my individual skull or your individual skull to ensure that we're not guessing about where we're putting this energy. We're putting it in the right place. We know exactly how much energy is going there. And again, we're making in that way, we make it safer and we make it more effective.
You've heard me talk about fasting before, but I get it. Fasting isn't easy to stick to. That's why I personally love Prolon, the 5-day fasting mimicking diet. It's backed by decades of research from Dr. Walter Longo at USC, and it gives you the benefits of fasting, cellular renewal, metabolism reset, and longevity support without giving up food completely. You will notice steady energy, better focus, and you won't feel deprived. If you want to try it for yourself, Prolon is offering my listeners 25% off your first order. Just head to the link in the show notes, or you can head to my website under the shop tab, or just go directly to prolonlife.com/BHB. It's a great reset if you're ready to support your long-term health in a real research-backed way.
Wow. Okay. This is way more intense than I even realized. You know, you go on the website, you look at this, but you just don't even realize how complex this is.
I mean, it's myself and... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to ask if someone has like depression, are you... So you're doing the MRI first, doing the whole scan. And say someone has depression or someone has anxiety, you are seeing certain neurotransmitters that are not cooperating correctly or things. What are you trying to fix?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So just to say about the company, so we were actually 5 years before we came out of stealth. And myself and our co-founder, our CEO, Jason Guinetti, we're two of the you know, the leaders in the ultrasound space. We've both been doing it for more than 10 years. We had the privilege of,
wow,
you know, when we were targeting a certain brain structure in our labs, we were the first person putting ultrasound into that brain region. You know, we're not alone as experts in the field, but it's been really, really meaningful. And also we're trying to solve very hard problems. So that's part of why. We present the conclusions as cleanly as we can, but we've been at it for together 25 years and in the company together for the last five before we came out of stealth. So you, using MRI, you can see very, in each of these different kinds of scans, you can see brain changes that are specific to what the person's, not just their depression, but their symptoms. I mentioned that earlier, you and I could both have depression. I'm not saying we do, but as an example, let's say you and I are both depressed. The word depression means something to us, and now we can talk about it. But maybe my depression, I don't sleep, I'm an irritable asshole, and I can't, like, I still do things, but I don't get any joy out of them. We call it anhedonia, right? Without hedonism, no pleasure. And maybe you are, you're not irritable at all, but you sleep a ton, it's hard to get out of bed in the day, and it's just hard to get motivated, right? Your depression has apathy. You and I both, as someone who diagnoses depression for a living, you and I both meet criteria for depression, but we don't have a single symptom that overlaps, right? So for your depression, as I described it, with your symptoms, I would expect to see a different neurotransmitter profile. If I looked at blood flow changes, they'd probably be different, like blood flow differences in unique brain regions. If I looked at the functional connectivity between certain regions, I'd expect to see different functional connectivity changes than the neurotransmitter, the blood flow, or the connectivity changes in my brain, because that's really symptom specific. So one of the things I love about ultrasound is you can target the specific network or structure in the network of the symptom. We've looked at turning the volume down for anxiety. We've looked at turning the volume up for anhedonia. If you're not able to get pleasure, can we increase that activity in that specific region, the reward region, and help people enjoy things more, get pleasure back? The answer is yes. So we can really aim for not just depression, but for the specific network related to the symptoms that characterize my individual patients, your individual depression.
Interesting. Okay. So if someone, is this also going to help someone who has neurological disease, Alzheimer's, and are you reactivating parts of the brain that might be confused or not working anymore?
So that's a phenomenal question. I feel very confident, and there's a lot of research published, some from my lab, some from clinics, some from other labs, that in psychiatric illness like anxiety and depression, we can make a major and meaningful change. In neurologic conditions, my hypothesis and my lab and some other labs and clinics are starting to kind of roll these out as well. I think ultrasound by itself will turn out to be a treatment, not a cure. And the reason I think that is, we've shown, for example, that in a single session, you can reduce Parkinson's tremor or reduce essential tremor. So Parkinson's is an action tremor. When I reach for the door, I shake. Essential tremor is a resting tremor. Sorry, I flipped those. But they're both tremors. One's resting, one's action, and we can reduce them following a series of treatments in a single day. But Parkinson's disease is a progressive deterioration of a certain group of neurons. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive deterioration of a certain group of neurons. And at least so far, we don't have evidence that we're reversing deterioration. We can increase activity in a region, bringing activity back, and that may have a downstream effect of potentially clearing out some of those plaques, potentially reinvigorating the network, because it's not just a region, right? All of the brain is different networks. Kind of think about like the airports in the US, right? You know, Delta has a hub in Atlanta, There's another hub in JFK, but those are all connected to other airports. Sometimes I'm trying to take one set of networks to hop from Atlanta to LA. Other times I'm trying to get from LA to Alaska, so I'm in a different network. So you can reinvigorate the network, but so far we don't have evidence that we're stopping that ongoing decline. I think if we start to combine ultrasound potentially as a delivery system for things like stem cells or exosomes or anti-inflammatory markers, those kinds of things, then we're combining the treatment with potentially regenerative factors, things that could unwind or slow or fight against that progressive deterioration. But I don't currently have a reason to think that ultrasound by itself would do that.
So you're working also at, how long have you been working with Dr. Sheldon Jordan, Dr. Jordan? And he's also using the ultrasound with exosomes to target the hypothalamus and kind of reverse brain age. Also, have you done this?
Yeah, great question. So I've been working with Dr. Jordan for about 8 years. I think maybe a little longer. Yes, I'm so the papers that he published looking at ultrasound in rats, showing that we can increase ultrasound exosome delivery with ultrasound. I'm a co-author on those. The ultrasound company that's part of the X Prize that we're top 40 and competing for now to be the top 10 for using ultrasound to deliver exosomes to the brain for reversing aging or increasing health span. I was one of the people who wrote that X Prize, and our ultrasound company is the ultrasound company associated with that. And yes, in January, I did it to myself for the first time.
Okay, where are your results?
Improved sleep, improved stamina. I work out a lot. I box, I play basketball, and I heal a lot faster. One of the things that bothered me most as a younger but still, aging human was, I think I was in my mid-20s when I started noticing that I was recovering more slowly. I thought that was going to take a lot longer, but I'm back to recovering like I did in my early 20s, which is nice.
Wow.
I started to get, I'm graying quicker than I expected to, but I started to get both hair darkening and hair regrowth in front of my scalp line, which was unexpected. And then I will not do this except for this scientific reason. I took 15 vials of my own blood, before I did, this reset. And then I waited 6 months and took more, and 15 more vials to see how things were changing. And while I'm still looking at waiting for some of those results to come back in, markers of inflammation went down. Markers of what we call TNF, so tumor necrosis factors, they improved. And my DNA age reduced. So, you can look at DNA methylation as a way to compare, to track aging. So that all improved. And then I'm also a medical advisor for an AI company that makes an app that tracks your biological age based on activity. You can look at blood results. You can look at, there's daily surveys. So you can kind of give it an idea of how you're eating, sleeping, you're staying active. And then it predicts your biological age, which is separate from your chronological age. I'm 38, but biologically I'm about 31. And then it makes AI-based recommendations for how to improve your life, as you mentioned, in kind of a daily lifestyle way. And I got about 6 months younger following the reset. I also think my mood is better. Not to disclose much, but I've had a hard year with family medical issues and some losses. And I've handled that with more grace than I would have in the past. That also may be that I'd like to think I'm maturing as a conscious creature. It's not a perfectly controlled experiment, and I'll be doing it again in January of next year. But I know nothing negative, and I remain hopeful for it as a future treatment for aging.
That is so cool. Yeah, I do think the healthier I become, the more emotionally stable I become. I used to react and these things to small, scenarios. And now I feel like when you have your health and you improve your health, you're able to adjust a lot quicker, a lot better. I don't know. My whole thing is the healthier you are, the happier you are. And I'm just such a believer in that. So for your device, what testing have you guys been doing? How long have you been using? Have you been doing on patients? What is your research so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the past 10 years, we've been doing research as a kind of a community, including myself and my co-founder, in our own labs with other companies' devices. We've been using our device under IRB-approved research trials in the U.S. for about the last 2 years. We have papers coming out soon. I can't say too much about them, unfortunately. But yeah, we've been looking at mental health populations as well as neurologic populations, and we've seen improvements in both. We're at the point now where we've started to roll out devices to clinics who are going to run trials for us in some of those populations. We're also putting together a registry, because one of the things that will happen is you give a device to a clinician or a researcher, and they're going to get their own IRBs and start doing research projects in the diseases that they're interested in. For example, I've never said this and someone not shaking their head. Everyone in America knows someone affected by the opioid crisis. Touch very close to home for me. That's true for most people. I have not gotten to do this yet as a research project or a clinical application, but I am excited to see if ultrasound can be a non-pharmacologic pain reducer. There's research already. Some of the first papers in ultrasound that came out of the Medical University of South Carolina showed that the answer is yes. You can turn down pain by targeting a part of the thalamus with ultrasound. But we haven't had to do that yet as an example. So we're putting together a registry so that all of the clinicians and researchers who use our device can upload their data. We can have this like massive repository of information to try to drive application faster, not just application and clinical use, but hopefully help us move through the FDA, who's also adopting AI at a rate that I'm grateful for. So hopefully we can kind of move this to people fast.
I know. I'm hoping we can, you know, all these things in the future can prevent medication that can become very addicting and really disrupt people's lives, not even to the extreme of, you know, maybe going to drugs or other things from pain medication, but like it can affect your daily life by, you know, making you tired, you know, your libido, your all these things with medication that have side effects. So the more we can do to get away from medication, I just think the better. So let's go back to Alzheimer's really quick. If someone comes to you with Alzheimer's, what would your typical solution or protocol be?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's the stuff we talked about at the beginning, which
is it bad?
Yeah, you're right. If I could say one thing real quick before we shift to that, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think one of the problems with the way we run clinical trials in this country, let's talk about stimulants for ADHD as an easy example, right? I've got an attention difficulty. I want a stimulant. They ran a clinical trial. Do stimulants improve attention? Answer yes. Now people prescribe it. What do they also do? They also tend to make anxiety worse. And they didn't necessarily look at that when they ran those clinical trials. So something that I believed as an ethical clinician and something that our company does is we collect all of the data, or in these areas that we were concerned or think that there's a reason to believe, you know, hypothesis that we might affect, not just the thing we're interested in, like attention, but also might we improve worsen anxiety. And we have the neuroethics board as part of the company. Because if you think about any of these devices, they have the ability to shift someone's mind state, which is kind of another way to say mind control, right? And, you know, Cambridge Analytica, there's a lot of people who've come to us, not Cambridge Analytica, but the idea of that, say, oh, hey, could you make people more susceptible to buy my product or vote for my candidate? And so they have an ethics board as part of a company to ensure that there are safeguards built around that, in the same way there may need to be safeguards built around clinical trials to ensure we really understand what all the risks are, is really important. To answer your question about Alzheimer's disease, part of the answer is those foundational things we talked about at the beginning. You know, from that diet, exercise, and sleep. But then but it's not just that recommendation, right? We put together, for example, a cognitive longevity program. So we have a sleep specialist. We know that cognitive behavioral therapy for sleep is better at helping you fall asleep faster, stay asleep longer, and having better quality of sleep than a drug is, to your point. So we have someone teach you sleep hygiene. We have a neuropsychologist do cognitive rehab, right? That started in stroke. You have a stroke, you lose a part of your brain, you no longer have the cognitive skill that part of the brain could do. but you have everything else. All of your other cognitive skills are still intact. So how do we leverage the still intact cognitive skills to bolster against what you've lost? So that cognitive rehabilitation can help people improve how they learn information to try to make it easier for them to get it back out. It can help them with executive skills. It can help them with attention. So we teach people how to improve their cognitive performance using cognitive longevity. We have nutritionists who specialize in dementia who help people with that. We have physical therapists and occupational therapists who specialize in working with older adults. I mean, acknowledge my bias. I've been doing Tai Chi and Qigong every day for almost 20 years. I had the privilege of training with the Grandmaster David Shin, who's a lineage holder. And there's a lot of really great research, not only on mindfulness as a method of staying mentally healthier, but on Tai Chi and Qigong for improving bone density in older adults, for improving balance in older adults. One of the biggest risks, whether you have dementia or not as an older adult, is falling. After a certain age, if you break your hip, you have a 50% likelihood of being dead within a year. So, you know, we try to do those things to improve the core of someone's health, getting them in with a neurologist, because there's a host of drugs now that are becoming more and more prominent to try to help both boost cognitive performance by playing with those neurotransmitters and also trying to clear out some of those plaques. And then also there's a family kind of support component to this as well.
So are you also implementing any stem cells, exosomes? Are you implementing ultrasound at the moment, or you're waiting for FDA approval?
So it depends, right? So access is a very challenging topic to discuss. So on the one hand, you know, my lab at UCLA was the first to get a grant from the National Institute of Health to study ultrasound as this kind of ultrasound as a treatment. What was our first grant? It was in Alzheimer's disease. We're still learning that prior to UCLA. There are other research labs and clinics who have IRB approved research projects in these different dementia groups. And that's a way to go try out a treatment in an experimental setting without it having FDA clearance yet. So that's one route. That's true of, for stem cells and exosomes as well. But we live in a rapidly changing world. Stem cells are now legal in Florida. Before Florida, people were going to Mexico or Costa Rica. So for those who have the means to go get access, that's always on the table. We have some IRBs allowing us to do research looking at ultrasound with exosomes or exosomes alone. So when regulations allow, we absolutely try to implement these things. When they don't, I think that the foundational ethical principle of research and clinical care is informed consent. So I think the best thing I can do is educate a patient about what is available, what the research says it might do, what the research and clinical data says the risks are, and then empower them to make their own choice. And I always try to with patients and their families, I try to give them as much information as I can so that and empower them, agency and autonomy, to go make the best choice that they believe in for themselves. And however I can help facilitate that, I try.
I know there's also a lot of brain peptides. Or is that something you also implement?
For transparency's sake, I'm not a prescriber. But I am a biohacker and a transhumanist, and short of putting an electrode into my brain surgically, I'm clearly down to try almost anything on myself, mad scientist-wise. So I do, personally, I'm a huge fan of glutathione. I do subcutaneous NAD several times a week. I do BPC-157 when I have an injury. Like, there are a lot of peptides that I'm a big believer in. I'm grateful to the physicians I work with who make them possible for me. In the context of dementia, absolutely. There are doctors that I refer my patients to kind of go through what would make sense to them peptide-wise, especially in context with their other, their other medications. But things like NAD, NMN, or NR, anything in that cascade, those are all related to the same cascade. Glutathione is incredible. And there are some other peptides that are gaining more traction in the brain space. And I think they're absolutely worth considering.
Yeah, I think there's so many little things that you can do, like even L-tyrosine, they don't realize that's really great to increase your dopamine, which is very deficient if you have Parkinson's. So there's like all these amazing supplements You know, plasmalogens. Do you use plasmalogens?
Yep, there's, I do.
What are your top supplements you recommend for brain health?
That's a great question. I actually have a sheet that I should have had pulled up, but it's Dr. Jordan may have mentioned it too. We collaborated on it, but it's supplements for longevity and aging. And one of the things that I learned from him is the recommendation for Valtrex and some of these antivirals, because as we mentioned, those some of these viruses that, you know, 85% of us are walking around with every day are part of what's getting bound up in those plaques in the brain. But so for, you know, for me, I like plasmalogens. Omega-3 fatty acids are a must. A multivitamin. I take a separate D vitamin. I take NAD. I take NAC. I do glutathione. I do L-theanine. I go and get a multi. I'm not a huge IV fan just because I got tons of tattoos and you can stick a needle in my muscle all day. But for some reason, I don't know. I'm weird about it. But I occasionally go get like a vitamin IV. I do exosomes. Approximately quarterly, although I used to. Now I'm doing them like, you know, I'm trying out this anti-aging thing, so it's currently once a year. What are some of the other big ones? I think that it's making sure you get a B and a D complex are incredibly important, and making sure you're doing what you need to take care of your urinary tract. It's what two of the biggest things that they go check if you have cognitive issues and go to the ER is you have a B12 deficiency and do you have a UTI? Because both of those can present as delirium.
Wow. Okay, that's good to know. I didn't know. So quick, I know we're also running, you know, into time, but we didn't really get much into anxiety or depression as much. So what would you suggest for those? I know there's also ketamine out there that's kind of helpful for depression. There's the what do they call that? The ganglion block, or that they're to reset your nervous system. Mm-hmm. So do you also recommend those procedures as well?
So I do. I am on the one hand, was in the whole space of psychedelics, I try to take a real, what I consider a really kind of backward thinking, rational perspective. Drugs like opiates were prescribed initially to treat something and they're now massively abused. There are drugs that we use recreationally first that also have medicinal properties. Why does it matter which order we got for either to medical use or abuse? So cultures have known for hundreds, if not thousands of years, that there are medicinal properties to psychedelics. Ketamine's FDA clear for depression. I've contributed to published papers that show that it's also good for social anxiety, generalized anxiety, and pain. And there's you know, growing evidence in from multiple companies who are doing research on ketamine use, of course, with, you know, prescribed by clinicians, that it has clinical utility outside of just depression. We know that ibogaine can be helpful for substance use, for example, and moving through withdrawal. So I really do like these drugs, but I think that it's really important to do them in the appropriate setting. I think what they talk about with integration or working with someone to make sure to make meaning of the experience that you've had so that you can integrate it into yourself and your life is that from the research and that I've done some ketamine-assisted psychotherapy as the therapist, but what I've seen, that integration piece is the determining factor on whether or not the change is really felt and lived for a prolonged period of time, right? But I think that's absolutely, it's contraindicated for some people. If you have a personal or family history of bipolar or psychosis, psychedelics are increase your likelihood of having a psychotic episode, right? So you need to be screened appropriately and do it in the right setting. But for a lot of people, they absolutely, I think, have value. Psychedelic ganglion blocks can be great, especially in the context of chronic PTSD. But again, with anxiety and depression, even when we're not talking about ultrasound, I really care about what your symptoms are. So think about the anxious person. Do you have the triumvirate is cognition or thoughts, emotions or affect, and physical. So do you have constant thought loops that you can't get out of? Do you have intense emotional, like hyper arousal? Or do you have physical anxieties, hard to breathe and your muscles are tense and your heart is racing? The answer is probably all three, and it changes over time. But like, which is the volume the loudest on? And so what kind of treatment you might want to go after is based on which of those symptoms is the most prominent one, the loudest one. And so I would make different recommendations for the patient who has mainly cognitive issues,
or most prominently cognitive issues with anxiety than I would the person whose physiological anxiety has them on edge and agitated and restless all the time. Where I would start with those two people is different. And instead of ganglion blocks, I typically recommend those as, you know, as maybe a third line treatment. But I've seen it be profound, especially in, you know, I worked at the VA at multiple stints in my career, and I've seen complex combat PTSD, which often has all three pretty loud, but including the physiological component. I've seen that be very helpful for veterans.
What are your thoughts on medication? Because, you know, I do, you know, I'm sure there's times where it's needed, but at the same time, there's so many risk factors, especially for anxiety or depression. They can be very addicting, and it can really change, you know, your personality, yourself. I feel like you can become numb. You can become tired. So what are your thoughts? And have you seen a struggle of people maybe trying to get off of them? Do you use them at all? Do you recommend them?
So it's a great question. Again, I'm not a prescriber, but I kind of see it in a few ways. One, I'm grateful that medications exist. There are some people at some points who need them. In classic psychotherapy, there's two components that we talk about. One, the most common number of times a patient goes to see a therapist is once. You're most likely going to see that patient who comes into your office to do psychotherapy one time. So give them everything you can, right? Some patients are suffering so much that they can't get a lot out of therapy yet. And so if we're using antidepressants as an example, I'm grateful that they exist because we say that they raise the floor so that the person's functioning well enough to get something out of therapy. I love Alan Watts. I like Buddhist philosophy quite a bit. When you don't need the medicine anymore, you should stop taking it. I think that antidepressants in this culture, for some reason, there's this idea that we shouldn't ever get off them, or that people are scared that if they do, what will happen next? And I think that that's a cultural issue that we really need to move away from. Well, I stopped, take your antibiotics until you're out of them, but don't stop them early and we get, you know, antibiotic resistant strains. But when you're done with your antibiotic, you don't go get another round, right? So I think I'm glad that they exist to elevate and raise the floor for people. But we need to shift our culture to then do the work, to learn the skill sets to manage your mood, manage your anxiety, manage your thought processes so you can get off the drug. Same thing with, I'm really grateful that anti-anxiety medications exist, although personally, I don't like benzos. Benzos scare me. People get addicted. One of the withdrawal symptoms of benzos, just like the withdrawal symptom of alcohol for the same reason, is seizures. I'm from Florida. I had family members during that pill mill time who were getting like 200 benzos and 200 opiates shipped to their door a month. It's just terrifying. And there are other drugs like beta blockers that they have very low, if any, side effects. They simply change the way your heart works a little bit in a very like longevity healthy way and reduce the physiological component of anxiety. There are some people for whom a benzo is in a time limited fashion warranted, but again, get off the medicine when you're not sick anymore. And with things like mental health issues, I really believe that the medicine should be there to support you while you do the work to learn how to manage those issues without them. We're always going to get scared. We're always going to have existential anxiety. We're always going to, loss is my worst thing, and I've had half a dozen people die this year. I'm not robust to that. I had a very hard time with it. But I also got into therapy to learn how to deal with my biggest fear in a better way. It happened to be 10 years ago, my brother died of cancer. So I've already faced my worst fear and had to live through it. So I'm trying to do the things that I need to become a conscious creature who can handle that in a more healthy way. But I also have a family and I have kids and I have to make sure that I keep the floor up so I can take care of them. But again, that's a certain way of thinking about it. And I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not arrogant enough to think that I am. But for me and how I choose to guide myself, a time-limited kind of buoy, or like I was my youngest daughter's 4. She uses those like her magic vest in the pool because she can't swim yet. For me, that's what that was. And I think for a lot of people, that's what it is, and it's valid. But we have to be careful about how we do it. And I know this is a long answer, but I want to say one more thing. I think in the same way that patients go and talk to a therapist once and then bounce, I think patients have as a culture, and I'm not blaming anyone, but I think we have a tendency to go try a drug once
And antidepressants, for example, can have some side effects, including sleep issues, reduced libido, difficulty achieving orgasm. Those are pretty big issues. And they just go, I'm off of this. Instead of going back to their doctor and saying, hey, I came in for a reason that was valid. We tried this drug. It's not working in the way I need. So let's continue to be scientists together and experiment on, do we change the drug? Do we change the dose? Do we add a second medication to balance things out? And I think that's the way we have to go about psychopharmacology, is dialing it in. Race car drivers driving a high-performance car don't go, oh, it didn't work right, I need a new car. They keep constantly making modifications because it's such a high-performance machine. I would argue, though I'm super biased by what I do, the brain is the highest-performance machine in your body. So dial it in. Tweak.
Yeah. And I think, too, I'm hoping more and more doctors and, you know, nutrition becomes a common practice with most doctor visits. Nutrition, sleep, all those other things can really implement the overall, you know, goal into health and wellness and healing. So as the pill is there, I think hopefully more and more doctors will implement the foundations of this as well. So quick, I'll let you go, but quick, what is the future of ultrasound, your technology? Where do you see brain health going?
Absolutely. So let's start with the diagnostic piece really quickly, which is you shouldn't have to come, when you come to see a neuropsychologist like me, we shouldn't be doing 6 hours of testing. Most of us are carrying around a phone that we're using every day. If I had access to how you use your phone, I could track every one of your cognitive functions, from attention to memory to planning, navigation, everything, in a real-time fashion every day. So I think the future is you're going to come in and you're going to dock your phone on my little station, and I'm going to pull up a beautiful graph showing, okay, for the last 2 years, your attention's been doing this. The last 2 years, your processing speed up. You're still real fast. Oh, your memory's getting a little worse. Like, the data is already there. The AI to help us find patterns in that data we don't already know exists. All that's missing, and I'm actually working on a book about this right now, all that's missing is doing something meaningful with the data, integrating it and pulling these things out. And that, one of the things that we talk about, it's called ecological validity, or like real world use, right? How many digits you can remember matter other than a telephone number, which none of us remember anyways, because we don't have to remember them anymore. But there is a reason that most of them are 7 digits, because almost all of us can remember 7 digits. We don't have to do that anymore. But the way we use our phone tells us so much about how we're functioning every day. So I think that from a diagnostic perspective, we're going to be tracking people's cognitive function in a really valid, useful to how we live our day life everyday way. And then I'm just going to, you know, download it and analyze it. Then what do we do with that? So I think we're going to, a lot of these lifestyle factor changes, if you're tracking within me how all these things are going every day, and I switch to the ketogenic diet, which I do for about 3 months every year, or I work on improving my sleep, then I can see in real time, you know, drop the phone back on that dock. Oh, wow. Well, my attention's getting a lot better. Or, you know, or my mood regulation. As you said, I'm healthier, so I'm happier. I have more bandwidth and more, you know, mono reserve, so I'm not reacting so much. I'm thoughtfully responding from my heart rather than from my, you know, reptile brain. So I think that we'll be able to implement these lifestyle changes and see these improvements in real time. And then I think for things like ultrasound, our long-term hope is to move from an in-clinic device, where you go to a doctor, just like you do a TMS right now, and a doctor uses it, you know, for treating a clinical issue like anxiety or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's disease, to an at-home device where I can wake up and go, my daughter woke me up, I'm tired, my attention's not quite as good, and I'm a little irritable when I'm sleepy. And then the ultrasound device will be able to target the different parts of my brain based on what I'm telling it I want to improve, and do it in a closed loop fashion, right? It starts to work on my attention, And I'm watching TV and I go, nah, I'm drifting off a little more. So I give, maybe there's an iPad. I say, no, wrong direction. And so it makes some modifications and it goes, okay, that's the right direction. And it dials it in for me. Or I see I'm trying to improve my anxiety and it shifts where it's targeting to a different part of my brain. And I go, nope, feeling more anxious. And I tap the iPad a little bit and it goes, okay, my bad. And it dials it in. So I tell it I'm right where I want to be. And I think that's what I mean by closed loop. It stimulates my brain. I give it feedback. It stimulates my brain. I give it feedback. So that's the loop. I think we'll be able to have kind of at-home health optimization with ultrasound or with peptides, with exosomes, etc.
Wow. Okay. I'm super excited. I know the future of health with AI is just astounding. I'm really looking forward to always having my biomarkers just on hand all the time. I'm hoping blood work, all these things, and then being able to be like, how do I switch my brain on to be the most optimal today? Sounds amazing. So I'm so excited. I can't wait for this device to come out in the future. It's going so fast. So I'm really excited, you know, to prevent disease and make people live happier, healthier lives. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure and I welcome the opportunity anytime. Lovely to work with you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Biohacker Blondie podcast. I hope Dr. Kun's insights open your eyes to how powerful ultrasound may be in reshaping brain health and treating conditions once thought untouchable. From mood disorders like depression and PTSD to neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, ultrasound is showing incredible potential to safely and effectively reset the brain. If you'd like to learn more, I've included links in the show notes to Dr. Kun's work and UCLA research program. And if this episode brought you value, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone who cares about optimizing their health. It truly helps me grow and bring you more conversations like this. Until next time, remember the brain is adaptable, change is possible, and with the right tools, you can biohack your best life.